Hi, it's Bianca Stone. I dreamed the words last night. DJ, leave me hidden. I was thinking when I woke up of the way the one who curates, plays the songs, stands in the box, the DJ booth. There's this element of the DJ that they are not the ones who necessarily made the song, but they assemble and put together and change the songs. I think this came from listening to this podcast that I'm about to give you and editing it and thinking about who the one is who gives us the songs, and if we are in fact the creator of the song or the DJ. I think we're a little bit of both. Poetry, as I've been talking so much about with people in interviews and then with my students as well, how much of our own intention and will and meaning making is going into the work of the poem consciously, and what does it mean to have this meaning making and this language come through us in a way that we're in somewhat ignorant of, you know, the ignorant of what it is actually saying. I think of songs too as beautiful events in the ear, body, heart. When we think about how a song means and how we accept it and take it into us and what it does to us, it's faith building within us. I feel very comforted by this dream. DJ, leave me hidden. DJ, leave me hidden. So this DJ who provides a medium in which the listener, I think, of the song that they're given, feels revealed. I feel revealed by poems. That I tremble sometimes when I find the right words. I feel frightened by it. I have to put the book down. I feel affected emotionally. And I feel grateful but also scared. It's the beauty and the terror. And these songs aren't meant to be understood, you understand. They're meant to comfort and terrify, John Berryman said. So the DJ gives us these songs and we feel in some ways revealed. Yet I sensed in these simple words that I received in the night that I was given a place in the song to be concealed at the same time. There's a part of the song that's envelopment. It's an envelope. Wherein words are put, yes, a language in beats and breath, instruments, tools, assembly of a kind of law and order of musicality. When this idea, my brother's a musician, he tells me there's these limited, you know, there's a limited scale. These are the scales that we know. And there aren't that many. But within these limitations, so much multiplicity in order. DJ, leave me hidden. It was a pleading. A pleading. Please expose me and leave me hidden at the same time. It's been a while since I've done a podcast. And in the meantime, my book has come out. It's called The Near and Distant World, and it's published by my press I've been with since the beginning, Tin House, which is now a Zando imprint. And I'm talking today on this episode with the new Ruth Stonehouse poet in residence, our steward of the house at this time, our first one in a series of of visiting poets in residence, Carson Jordan, and she's coming from New York City, and she's also working as my assistant and apprentice, and she and I have been traversing around the United States to give readings for my book, and we've been doing lots of Q&As, and she's been so wonderful in just prompting the conversation with me around this book. And that's what happened today. It was actually a video that we were doing with my friend Joel Gardner, who I've been doing some video projects with. So I'm going to add a clip from the video that I made with Joel and Carson, and I'm going to put that in the show notes on the podcast page. I really hope that you get the book and tell me what you think. If you're listening to this podcast, everything in this book I've been working on connects to the things that I have been talking about on the podcast over the years, especially Rilke. Rilke is threaded throughout. I have several quotes from Rilke poems in the epigraphs in the third section. How can distance be so unendingly near, yet not come any nearer, not all the way? That's translation by Franz Wright, you know, one of my other favorite poets, and it's from the poem From Time to Time. How can distance be so unendingly near, yet not come any nearer? Another paradox for the people in the club listening to the DJ's songs. So if you want a copy of the book, I will give a free copy to whoever listens to this and messages me first on, we'll say, my email, bianca@ruthstonehouse.org, and tells me one thing they like got out of listening to this episode and that they're thinking about. And I am in the midst of redoing a lot of the podcast things and the website with the Ruth Stone House, which is overseeing all of this business. And we're very much hoping that the listeners of the podcast engage more with the Ruth Stone House. And so please follow us on social media or sign up for the newsletter on the website, ruthstonehouse.org. I will leave you now with my conversation with Carson Jordan, a poet and teacher and friend and young apprentice. When I think of inspiration happening, when I think of receiving language from the outside, either, you know, the ultimate other coming through me, I do think of that bone at my center glistening. And so there's something, you know, but then also sometimes maybe the genitals are receiving this. The focus can become too much about the publishing scene and all that. But at the same time, I know how important a book is for a poet. You have to get to a state where you are so in the work, discovering and creating a community and creating conversations with other writers. That it's inevitable that you will get published. And it's I'm not saying it's easy at all. I've had so many failures. I continue to have failures.
The book can then come up. Are you ready?
I'm gonna read a poem, In Shadow Who Made These Words, which it was actually the last line of my last book. And I was gonna have it be the beginning of this book, but it wasn't quite the right beginning poem, although now that I'm looking at it, maybe it was. It's too late now. In Shadow Who Made These Words, all poets are liars, my play begins. Plato was probably right. With this enfeebled mind, my only recourse is poetry. Behind my head, heads begin to nod. They doze in the surgical amphitheater behind my eyes. I do not know what I hold more clearly in my mind, the pain of what I had or the pleasure in what I don't. In the after lyric of childhood,
You can barely stand to look back without laughing at how calmly desire and memory see fit to destroy everything. And thank God. Let me be run through with the wooden javelin of truth. Let them remove my breastplate and grill and wipe the mud from my brow. Let them place a rose in my hand and mutter the old prayer and wave two fingers over me. Let my only work be this, to stare back into the blue iris of the sky. It's like a project in imperfection or something, ironically, you know? Maybe the more we edit something or feel the need to edit something, the more fragmented it is. At the same time, I got to a point with some of these poems where it was like, I thought I would put it aside and never look at it again because it was just too mutated at that point, you know, too mangled, mm-hmm. too touched. And you can't touch something that much and have it come through looking anything but like a freak. But but it wasn't so with some of the poems. Some of the poems I said, no, I put it aside, but I went back to it. And after it, you know, something had aged in it and distilled in it on its own, in its silence and space, that I was able to look at it again and finish it and feel good about it. And it's funny because when you take something out of a poem, you still feel its ghost there. And you think, should I have not taken that out? You know, or does it still leave its flavor behind somehow? You know, that can be a problem that comes up in workshop where someone's like, I don't understand this. Why is this here? This seems really too ambiguous or too left field. And it's like, oh, it referenced something that's no longer there. It echoed back to something that was earlier that isn't there anymore. So that can be a problem, but I think it can also be an interesting, authentic recording of what it even is to be alive. You know, things are missing, things echo back. You don't know what they attach to anymore.
A book as intensively as I've done this one, however you said it.
Okay. Looking at this printed, finished version, I don't think I've edited any of my books as much as I edited this book to the point where, you know, it was already at the printer and I was sending messages to my editor who was going crazy to change things. But I think, ironically, the level of tinkering and editing and adding and going back to some of these poems made the whole book, looking at it now, I still see it's a book that relies on its own fragmentation and its own inchoate things, you know, its own inchoate ideas and feelings. But I think that's the emphasis of the book is fragmentation and the unending idea. So I'm embracing all the things that I want to change still. And I'm loving the things that I did change and go back and do and figure out. When you're dealing with love and bond and thresholds, that's what happens.
Bianca, I'm wondering if you feel muscle memory with any of these poems.
I like that. I think I just had it. Mm-hmm. I like thinking about muscle memory in terms of the poem because the poem is so tied up with the body and an embodiment of language, And I mean, there's some parts in some poems that every time I get to that part, something happens in my body. And it can be hard when you're giving a reading or something. I mean, it's not that it's a bad thing that's happening, but yeah, it's and I couldn't even tell you what is happening. So physical associations with certain words in certain orders, for sure. And then I think that maybe that's exactly what we're trying to do when we write, you know, is like access the way that our body is affected by our experiences, and to somehow have memory encoded in a languageless affect of the body, and to put that on the page and to have the reader somehow, it must do something to them too at those moments. It's funny when people's reactions happen at those little moments, and sometimes they're laughing and sometimes they're, and that's good,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because it's like some people recoil and some people laugh, and that means that paradoxical muscle memory, something's happening there.
It's like a somatic experience through the body for yeah. everyone.
Yeah.
But sometimes you don't know when those moments are hitting for them.
Right.
And then it happens, and then you get an association then. You get a touch point.
By seeing them. Yeah. Yeah, it's weird to think about memory being encoded into language mm-hmm. of a poem, especially if, like, that poem sails on across time. You're gone. You know, you're in the ground. Somehow you're, right, I deal so much in thinking about, oh, how calmly desire and memory see fit to destroy everything. Well, right, I mean, I'm trying to see what is memory, what does it mean to deal in memory mm-hmm. when you're talking about language and the event of the poem that is very constantly current, if you're doing it right. Weird, encoding what has been in what is now. Mm-hmm. But it's paradoxical because it keeps occurring. The past keeps making itself known in new ways. But I think when we talk about muscle memory, we're talking about something that's not cognitive or something, right? Mm-hmm. It's not, you're not aware of it. You don't have to think about it. It just happens, right?
Well, I watch it happen to you. I watch your mouth take over. It's like really cool. There are certain poems where I know, like, that's the spot that you hit, and you like ride it. It's yeah. like when you watch someone, like, I don't know, I'm thinking about, like, when you watch Tony Hawk skate the bowl.
Hell yeah, yeah.
And when he catches the certain moment that his whole body knows what to do. And it's like, I watch you do that with certain poems.
Give me a cut. We're rolling in again.
You were saying that watching Tony Hawk
skate the bowl,
but no, it made me think of something. Oh crap.
In regards to muscle memory like that?
Oh, I know what it was. Where you said you could see it in my mouth. Right?
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking about how the poem pulls you along. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's like a force in the world, like a tide, like a bird migration. You know, it's something. I love that I can construct my own language to take me away with it without it, it's autonomous in a way. It's beyond me, thank mm-hmm. God, let it be beyond me. I but I think it's good to think about those people who do sports that are, it's like when it goes to art, when it moves over mm-hmm. into artistry, when, you know, watching a basketball player pirouette in the air, you know, those mm-hmm. moments where they're just all, it feels in one way chaotic, but they're all in this dance together. And the poets are like, the poetry of movement. Mm-hmm. But it is a kind of losing yourself, yeah, letting something else take you. And I think for poets giving readings and things, when you feel really nervous to get up there in front of everybody and you feel like you're trembling and you can't do it and you're so afraid, but there's this calm in remembering that you have the poems with you up there mm-hmm. and that the language can take over and you can lose yourself. And I don't know if we've ever have ourselves, but we think we do. But you let yourself be lost, and I don't know, it's weird because you feel very alone in those moments, blessedly alone while everybody's looking at you. But it's just you and the words and the words. And then knowing that they're there looking at you alone with the words creates that circumstance mm-hmm. of being able to speak and be authentically performing, right? There's, I'm jumping around here, but it makes me think that in those moments of acting, you hit that. Mm. And it's like it's acting and you're wearing a mask and you're in the persona of the poem, but it's more, almost more authentic than the everyday because you've, I don't know.
Well, it's a replication of the feeling when you wrote it that you were trying to capture, but you're feeling it in action of reading it. It's the performance of when an actor is feeling the feelings of the speaker and they're like in it.
Yeah, and what a weird thing that if you can create a scenario in which to contain something a container in which to have that spontaneity occur as if it is spontaneous, right? It's not, it's planned out yeah. in a way, but it's already been written mm-hmm. but there's something about the arrangement of the words that you've chosen and labored so hard over in a certain order with certain musicality and certain silences and caesuras and all of it. But then you also have who you are embodying the poem.
Right.
You have the setting. You have the other in which you speak to, right? So, because that's the other thing too, is that I think when I'm embodying those words, it's not really just me and the words. It's me speaking to you. Even mm-hmm. if my heart is only thinking of one person, I'm reading those words, it's not really just me and the words. It's me. It's like, oh my God, what a beautiful thing, right? It's the mm-hmm. other, it's nobody, and it's a very specific person.
Because you don't think about the addressee of your poem. You're not, when you're writing it, you're not thinking about the addressee as in the person who's going to be reading it. You think about the person you're thinking of.
Yeah, yeah.
But then that person who reads the poem is actually the person who completes the poem
yeah,
every time.
Yeah.
And that's something that you've said many times that I've like really held on to, is like the reader completes the poem, one hopes, many times, like over and over and over again.
Sorry.
It's like looking at to reference and like books, like five books open. I was like, this is insane.
Okay, we're rolling.
Okay.
Carson, you want to ask that question again?
Well,
I think it was a statement.
Oh, okay.
Just
okay.
That the,
yeah,
you know, something that you said mm-hmm. as a teacher is that the reader finishes the poem many times over and over and over again. But what I heard you saying is like you're not thinking about the reader, the person who's going to open the book when you're writing the poem. You're thinking about maybe someone specific, whoever the you is. But then this person gets to come in and become the you, and the poem completes them, and then they complete it by reading it.
I know, as well, we may think we grasp towards completion, but it's again it always feels a little frayed, a little fragmented, incomplete. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm learning a little bit about that, you know, like letting oneself be incomplete. But I think there's some requirement of offering one's incompleteness to the other that braids something really important in moving, in that movement towards wholeness, which, you know, I kind of start the book off like gesturing towards with the Hegel, like the oblique reference to Hegel's idea of the infinite whole, you know, and ending that poem with, it doesn't need to know where it came from to know it is part of the whole, and it is snow, and it falls on your face and ends, and nothing really ends, and everything is already over, you know. It's like, I love this idea that you know, many other thinkers and poets have talked about in terms of the poetry's unique situation of acknowledging the in its own incompleteness and its need for the other, mm-hmm. and it's speaking to the other to complete it, right. To make meaning with it is probably more accurate than complete. But even that is complicated because there's something else going on besides meaning making, and even just the gesture towards the other seems to be in itself, in language, mm-hmm. Seems to be like the whole impetus of the poem, right? Because there's this like beautiful thing. I think about, okay, when I get confused and lost in these little moments, I think, what happens when I read a poem? Mm. When I'm reading one of my favorite Rilke poems, in a moment of great need for, I think for comfort, but I think I just am in, I feel closed off from the world. Mm-hmm. I feel like Faust in those moments when he's like, nothing gives me joy, and yet here I am surrounded by all these books. I'm just, you know, I want to feel excitement for the earth. Like, I mm-hmm. want love to stir me. So I look to these poems, and those things are, and even reading Faust, right? Even reading Goethe's Faust, like, I go to these moments and I feel clarity and I feel understanding in the work and the journey and the path that is so confused and dark, and you can't see all the way where you're going at all. I feel so with somebody else in those moments. Mm. And they're in my whole psyche. That's, what a gift. But it's, I was just thinking about my students and sort of emphasizing this too, that there's this maddening thing in poetry of not understanding everything. Mm-hmm. How can something that you don't understand give you solace and solidarity and comfort and understanding? I don't know.
Well, those who get it, and those who don't.
Yeah.
You know?
They get not, those who get not getting it.
Yeah, those who get not getting it will get it.
Yes.
And those who won't get not getting it won't.
Yeah, and thank God.
I know.
I don't want this idea that everybody in existence has to like poetry and understand it and do it. No. There's a reason there was these, you know, mystical groups, you know, the ones who hold this.
There's rigor.
The work is the thing.
Yeah.
It's not getting information. It's the long work of not understanding, and then understanding, and then forgetting, and then I loved that idea. I forget who said it, but it was somebody French, who. But that poetry is like a key you keep losing and finding again. What a gift to know that you don't always have to have it. You know that you can keep looking for it.
I want to ask you another question.
Yeah.
I think, and it relates to this, because you're talking about those who get it and who don't, And, like, to me, poetry comes as, it does come as this outer body thing that comes into our body. We get a message and then we want to seek further. And I'm wondering where in your body you feel the inspiration when a poem is coming to you. Where does it come to you?
So interesting. That makes me nervous.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. No, you don't have to be sorry. It means something good is good. Something is happening. Let me just start too, but just acknowledging the idea of poetry coming from outside the self, mm-hmm. and through the self, which I know Ruth talked a lot about. Mm-hmm. Ruth Stone. Right, this will always be an immaterial idea that takes a certain amount of faith. What is this that comes from outside me, and is it possible that something unseen is affecting me in this way where it's speaking through me? This is an old idea, the poet being an oracle for the mm-hmm. gods, or mm-hmm. to be able to be in an ecstatic state in which something is moving through you. That God is touching you, even though you can never prove it. What an important part of being a poet, and one is always waiting for that to happen. And like, we have to, you know, some people happen, it happens randomly, but most of people are like, I'm a poet. How can I cultivate a state of receiving those things mm-hmm. and paying attention to that? And you've probably had, yeah, I know, like, you staying in Goshen being mm-hmm. like, I'm ready to receive, you know,
yeah.
and the things are coming.
Yeah.
So this is an intriguing idea. Okay, well, practically, what part of the body is it entering through? Like, I would mm-hmm. think like it's entering in my like ear, you know,
yeah.
Because I think we talk a lot about the poetic ear and learning to attune the ear.
Right.
But there's also the eye,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's the literal ocular eye, but then there's the eye of the heart too,
yeah.
you know? And so physically one feels, I think, like right now I'm having feelings.
Yeah.
I'm having like some anxiety, so I'm feeling it like in my heart, obviously.
Yeah, like in your chest.
Yeah, in my chest. And. At one center, at my center, a bone glistens, a wondrous bone I made.
Mm.
That Ruth Stone line, so good, one of the best lines. And I think when I think of inspiration happening, when I think of receiving language from the outside, either, you know, the ultimate other
yeah.
coming through me, I do think of that bone at my center glistening.
Mm.
And so there's something, you know, but then also sometimes maybe the genitals are receiving this. I don't, you
yeah,
know.
Or the very top of the head.
Right.
Know, where it's like that image
yeah.
of like God dropping down inspiration to like the top of the head. And then some people view it like a fountain where they're actually just
ooh.
A spigot that it goes into their mouth and it comes from this other thing.
Yeah.
And there's another, you know.
So it's more like a wellspring.
Exactly. And it's like every person feels this inspiration happening in a different part of their body. And I think many of us can connect on, like, I feel the chest thing because it does feel like an anxiety when you get the line and you're
yeah.
like, I have to write that down. It has to. But when it comes freely, I feel like it comes from the top of
it does.
My head.
It
like
comes
into
from top.
The top of
yeah.
my head in this
yeah.
way where it's, It feels like I'm being plugged into something or something's being dropped on me.
Huh.
And so that bone, those are different parts of the poem.
Right. I was reading about St. Teresa having this vision of an angel stabbing her heart with a golden arrow over and over again. Very erotic.
Oh.
And having the God burn in her, all through her. I know. Very Jouissance. So, right, it is a penetration of the body,
mm-hmm.
right, from the outside. And God, let my boundaries be breached. like that Rilke, that wonderful Book of Hours. There's in Rilke's Book of Hours poem, he has a poem about you cities, don't you, you should long to be breached. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The enemy isn't gonna come. You've got, you know, they're not gonna come on their own.
Yeah.
But yeah, the container of the body and its boundaries, receiving, and where can it break in? Let me be run through with the wooden javelin of truth. Mm. Same kind of thing, right? But you know, all this is also making me think: when does it come up through the feet? Because I think so much about roots, right? So that's like a different kind of, literally groundedness.
Yeah.
So maybe the coming through the roots is more of a slow draw of the water instead of the rush of the wellspring.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that kind of inspiration is the slower kind.
Well, I think you do that kind a lot with your walks.
Oh, in the woods,
I think you're literally, you're seeking something. So it's not about, I don't like the word find. I don't think that it's about finding. I think it's the process of seeking, and that's the slow draw up through the feet. It's like almost like you have to soak your feet in the process of seeking.
Okay, but that just opened up a whole other door of like thinking about seeking and finding, right? So
yeah.
Like I think about that too, because it's like, how can a tree and its roots find or seek, right?
Mm-hmm.
For one, right, that there's a contrast or paradox here between being rooted and walking.
Mm-hmm.
But when I walk in the woods, I feel the rootedness, right? So that's interesting. I do seek. I have always thought of myself as a seeker, but now I'm rethinking the idea of looking at signs that are already here, because I started to worry. I don't know if this is similar, but let's see where it goes.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is the same, I should say. Let's see where it goes. Because I feel like we just talked about this.
You just said it to me.
You
just said it to me right before. You said, like, I don't have superstition, but I see.
Oh, right.
I see the signs.
Right. I burned myself last night and I thought, oh, this is a bad omen. But then I thought, I made a decision some years ago that I wasn't going to be superstitious anymore. Mm-hmm. And it was a great decision. But I look at the signs that are here, mm-hmm. and I don't turn my back on the signs.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I've gotten. And this is what the poet learns as a good analyzer of poems, right? What's here? What is here in front of me? I analyze. Mm-hmm. I look at the signs. This is a spiritual act to do such, is to look at what's here and to not keep seeking the other thing.
Right.
That's where the seeking needs to be. You need to pay attention to how you're seeking, because if you're always seeking the next thing and you're not paying attention to what's already here, then it's something else is happening. Avoidance is happening.
Mm.
Well,
it's the past, the present, the future, even in tarot. When you pull three cards, the past is actually 5 seconds ago. The past is you saying what you've just said right now.
Right, everything.
The now is the conscious realization of this is happening right now. We are in the now. The future is steps beyond that.
Right.
It could be 5 minutes from now.
Right.
But the now is a conscious act of now. And I think the seeking actually takes us out of the process of being in the now to receive.
Yeah. Right, because if you're seeking, you're not looking at right now, which could tell you a lot about what is and will be.
Right.
So this is something that I have to keep reminding myself, because I can get really excited about finding new things, reading a new book, receiving a new letter. What about what I already have?
Mm-hmm.
That I need to keep looking at? And this is the secret of poetry too, to come back to the idea of the secret keepers, is that, you know, one goes back to spiritual texts again and again and again to seek what is, and seek and find what is already there.
Right.
And if the language is true, one never arrives. You keep arriving. but you can keep going back. It's what the answer is never given. You fall in love with the whole act and questioning and of the language that, oh, it's so good. It's so good because I want to write poems like that. I want to write poems that you can't say this is what it means. This is the one meaning of it. No. I want to write poems that keep changing. How do you write poems that keep changing as if they're all their own consciousness? It's that's why translation is so interesting, yeah, which I know we're both really into right now. Because the more you translate, every generation has its own translation of Rilke, mm-hmm. you know, and it should, because each translation shows you that there's no one translation of anything, of any experience.
Yeah, it makes, I was reading this essay by Alejandra Pizarnik to Anne, actually. Aww. And she says that editing a poem, the process of editing a poem feels like when you've found yourself taking a wrong turn, but already way down the path.
Yeah.
And you're like, wait, hold on. And it's this whole backtracking. And that, to me, is the process of a poem. Like, even, you know, when we're looking at a finished product of something and going, oh, I wish I could have changed this. It's like, that's yeah. just the process of going back for anything. Nothing ever feels done if you're the maker. Like, we're not fucking blacksmiths.
But I
want to be.
I want to be.
So
I really would love to forge something in steel. But then you melt it down again.
Exactly. And then you go, no, and then you go, actually, I have to use this now for like a pot, because now that's the necessity of the times. That one time the necessity is that I need a sword. The next time is the necessity that I need a pot or a basin or a vase.
Well, one forges a book, right?
Yeah.
And I feel like it's really fun to talk about making a book as a writer, because on one hand, you know, I tell my students, like, if they're really hung up on the book, I sympathize, you know, and I've been trying to get this book published for, you know, 10 years and everything. And I'm like, okay, well, the focus can become too much about the publishing scene and all that. I say, right? But at the same time, I know how important a book is for a poet. I know that having a book is like what one works towards.
Right.
And it's an incredible feeling to do it. It's also, to be realistic, like, if you publish a book when it's too soon and it's not ready and stuff, you can feel a lot of regret about that, you know, and you can't take that back. But but also you publish a book and you're like me and you're like, oh my God, there's a typo. Oh God, I wish I hadn't changed the ending of this poem. I'm fixating on it
yeah,
so
but
badly.
God intervenes. Don't you feel like it's God intervening in a way? Just like God intervenes with, like, you know, you try to get a book published and it's not happening. That book is not happening. And then all of a sudden it happens. And maybe at that moment, yes, you publish something and you realize, oh, I shouldn't have, that last line, I shouldn't have changed, or I should have changed.
I think way with publishing anything. I mean, imagine back when they had like one book
they're
in the whole town.
They're doing it on a piece of skin.
Yeah.
Monks were writing the shit on a piece of skin, and you want to snap your fingers
yeah,
and have a small press
right.
make a book for you?
Right, right.
Stop talking
and
about
your
goddamn
book.
There's
so many
book.
Books in the world.
Yeah.
Like, there's too much.
Yeah.
At the same time, I would be devastated if I didn't have a book out. Yeah, I would feel like my life wasn't, but I've dedicated my life to this, right? This is the most important thing to me. But you have to get to a state of practice.
No, sorry, I'm going to have to ask you to just move a little bit this
hair.
Way. Thank you.
Sorry.
The book, you have to get to a state where you are so in the work of writing and discovering and making movements as a poet and a thinker and a writer that, like, and creating a community and creating conversations with other writers,
yeah,
that it's inevitable that you will get published. Like, ideally that's, and it's, I'm not saying it's easy at all, but my experiencing with publishing has been that, where I am really dedicated, I'm humbled, I've had so many failures, I continue to have failures, but I'm so excited about the act mm-hmm. of writing that mm-hmm. that's really the most important thing. And not only that, I'm actually more even excited maybe about the act of reading and engaging with poetry and wanting to find my place within that conversation. And it's like a lifelong project.
It doesn't stop after the book is done. And I think that that's
a whole other thing starts happening.
That's the strange thing yeah. about the focus on the having the final finished product of something, because it's actually like this is actually a gateway and a doorway and a threshold that you get to pass through. You've yep. done this. And then it means that you get to go places and talk to people about yes. this, meaning that then people talk to you about their things. And then it's a back and forth. It's less yeah. of like, this is done and now it's done and I check it off my list. It's like, no, this actually is just like, it's like almost like a beautiful arch that you walk through.
Yeah. And you carry it with you and you, right, you go and you like, reading so much about Paul Celan saying a poetry, a poem is nothing more than a handshake, or that it is synonymous with a handshake. That's an incredible idea, mm-hmm. the relationality of mm-hmm. poetry, which is a simple gesture towards the other mm-hmm. and with the other, a touch, a squeeze,
yeah.
a moment together of greeting or farewell. It's a boundaried movement as well, mm-hmm. you know, it's not a kiss with a tongue, you know, a poem is not a kiss, it's no. a handshake. And I would also, it could be a bow as well.
Totally.
So I think you're exactly right, like we're about to go on this tour together mm-hmm. that you've so gracefully arranged, and we will be engaging with poets across the country. And, you know, I'll be traversing the world if I have anything to say about it.
Hell yeah.
And yes, it's so fun talking with this Italian guy and the German, my German translator. And I love that. So yeah, poetry is relational, and the book puts you out there with others.
It's about community. It's not about, you know, it was funny last night. I was reading the introduction to a, you know, Alejandro Pizarnik collection that we're studying, and yeah. the whole first section was about Paul Celan, and I felt this moment of like, yeah. I felt this buzzing moment where I was like, oh my God, even though I'm not in the room with Matthias and Bianca,
yeah.
are the poets that we're talking about, they're touching
yeah.
in this moment in time. And like, that is what it's kind of all about.
So true.
Like, it's all
it's
about.
It's not coincidence.
No, it's coincidence. Not coincidence. Yeah. It's not. It's about this moment of like, even beyond death, your words will connect to other people
yeah.
more in this web. And so when you have a book come out, it's actually just all about the connections that come from that then lead to like, handshakes down the line.
Yeah. Exactly.
Forever.
And that's the gift, you know, it's not about mm-hmm. everything being happy and idealistic
no.
and it's all going well, but you
no.
do it anyway, and there's so much pain but pleasure in it too. And I again, to come back to that, of course, that you do it in this call to you, to thou, and I'm so grateful that you and I are sitting here right here mm-hmm. now, seeing that handshake
mm-hmm.
and us joining in, yeah. joining in. Yeah.
That rules. I forgot his ass was even there.
I know. We're just in it. That's the good thing. That's the good stuff. Yeah.
Fun.
I'll read one short thing.
Would you like to read me a poem?
I'll read you a poem to end our mini interview.
Please.
Thank you, my darling.
Of course.
Nothing is ever finished, only abandoned. I'm always preparing the end. The end is very old. I keep arriving at it. I sit in front of the camera, stand in for a third thing. My hair brushed, my shine blunted, my teeth aching to the point of madness. My body is taut. One moment I am returned, then gone, then returned to the day and city and time the ground of April in a room? Do you smell the scent of mud on the air, enchanting this moment as if in time? Oh, and this is the sound of your voice, and this is the sound of mine.